Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stoddard Kennedy. Chapter 19. Completing the Book. The Registry of Deeds for Essex County in the state of Massachusetts shows that on March 31, 1875, Francis E. Bessie, in consideration of the sum of $5,650, deeded to Mary M. B. Glover, a widow woman of Lynn, the property at No. 8 Broad Street. The house is still there, carefully preserved, a small 2.5-story building surrounded by a narrow strip of lawn with a large shade tree at one corner. Its purchase was a great adventure for Mary Patterson, and an act of faith of no small order. But it solved for her the wearing problem of a place to live and write. After her plan to move to Cambridge and help Bancroft with his work failed to mature, she took rooms in a boarding house in Lynn at No. 9 Broad Street. And looking out of her window one morning, she saw a new sign on the house opposite, to the effect that it was for sale. The thought came to her that if she could only manage to buy that house, reserve the best room on the ground floor as a classroom, a small room for herself as a bedroom and study, and rent out the rest, it might afford her the quiet and sense of settlement for which she craved as her book neared completion. Once she had made up her mind, Mary always acted promptly, and it was not long before the deed was signed and the house was hers. However viewed, this act of Mary Patterson's in buying the house at No. 8 Broad Street marks quite definitely her emergence out of tradition into history. Up to now, the story of her life could have presented to the onlooker no unmistakable trend or purpose. There was no focal point towards which the rays of her effort could gather. She may have known, and her followers may have suspected, that the movement, if so it may be called, for which she stood was already much wider than any outward and visible sign would lead one to expect. If bad news travels fast, good news often travels faster. And already, as has been seen, requests for help and teaching were reaching Mary from as far afield as California. Nevertheless, concrete evidence of establishment and growth was largely lacking. Word of it all had gone out through so many devious ways that two neighbors might quite well be interested without either knowing of the other's interest. As soon as Mary Patterson bought her house and put up, as she did, her blue and gold sign bearing the legend, Christian Scientists Home, the movement, as a movement, was born. It was not long before Lynn was talking about it, and news items appeared in the press about Mary Patterson and her teaching. Georgine Millmine, in preparing her articles for McClure's magazine, made exhaustive inquiries about these early days from a number of people in Lynn, then alive, who could remember them, and she stresses the growing sense of wonder which these people recalled over the devotion of Mary Patterson's followers and the reports of healing work. Whatever trouble and disappointment she had with individual students, their number, from now on, constantly increased. And as Millmine has it, for every deserter, there were several new adherents. Perhaps the most remarkable of all is the vivid recollection of these people, even of those who afterwards were completely alienated from her of the power of her teaching. Their common testimony was that what they got from her was beyond equivalent in gold or silver. They speak, Georgine Milmine writes, of a certain spiritual or emotional exaltation which she was able to impart in her classroom, a feeling so strong that it was like the birth of a new understanding and seemed to open to them a new heaven and a new earth. They came out of her classroom to find that for them the world had changed. They lived in a new set of values. One of the students, who was closest to her at that time, says that to him the world outside her little circle seemed like a madhouse, where each inmate was given over to his delusion of love or gain or ambition. And the problem which confronted him was how to awaken them from the absurdity of their pursuits. Meanwhile, in spite of her rapid attainment in other directions, Mary had but one care and one labor, the completion of her book. Besides the large classroom on the ground floor, she retained for her own use only one small room, a little attic on the third floor, lighted by a skylight in the roof which could be pushed outwards and upwards to secure ventilation. Here she completed her manuscript and made her final corrections. This combined study and bedroom was furnished austerely enough, and was unheated save for a small kerosene stove. On the walls, the sole adornment, a framed text from the Bible which ran, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." It was, however, for Mary, a home, at last. The vacant rooms were quickly filled for the most part by those who were eager to have her teaching, and there and then seems to have been born that devoted service on the part of certain individuals which Mary needed so much, and which, in varying degrees, she was to enjoy for the rest of her life. At first, this position of service was never filled for long by one individual. But when one fell out, there was always another to take his place. It was George Berry and Miss Dorcas Rawson who arranged all the details of the purchase of No. 8 Broad Street. George Berry, it will be remembered, had been a member of the much-discussed first class. When he met Mrs. Patterson, he was suffering from tuberculosis in a serious form, and his healing was one of the most striking that there had been up to that time. His devotion to Mary was deep and sincere, and in addition to copying out her manuscripts, he sought to relieve her as much as possible of all lesser cares. He arranged all the details of moving and furnishing, attended to all the business matters, ran errands and wrote letters, and in every way showed himself to be most helpful. And yet, although in the fullest sense of the word a disciple, he was not an apostle of the new faith. No one could have been more devoted or efficient in the matter of carrying out instructions than was George Berry. but he had none of those qualities of initiative and independent action which Richard Kennedy had possessed in such a marked degree. George Barry was an excellent orderly, but he had none of the qualities of a sergeant major. Mary Patterson had need of someone with these qualities, someone upon whom her other students could depend, who could be trusted to speak for her intelligently and authoritatively when she was not present to speak for herself. Such a man, Richard Kennedy, at his best, had been. And up to now, his place had never been filled by another. It was not, however, to remain vacant much longer. As will be remembered, Putney Bancroft was first introduced to Mrs. Patterson by a man in his department at the shoe factory, one Daniel Spofford. Mrs. Spofford, who had been greatly benefited in health by Richard Kennedy, was planning to enter a class to be held by Mrs. Patterson, and together they urged Putney Bancroft to join. This, as has been seen, he did. Mrs. Spofford also joined, and although her husband for some reason did not, he was apparently very much interested in the whole subject and studied his wife's manuscript eagerly at night. The two left Lynn shortly after the close of this class for the far west, where Daniel planned to take up farming or some employment which would give him outdoor work. They carried copies of Mrs. Patterson's manuscripts with them. And the more Daniel studied them, the more convinced he became of their verity. He gradually evolved from them a system of healing which he thought was more or less his own. And after some 4 years in the West, during which he found himself devoting less and less time to farming and more to the practice of healing, he decided to return to Lynn and devote all his time to the work. Whether or not he had heard from his friends there, as indeed would seem very likely, of the rapid development of Mrs. Patterson's teaching is not clear. But when Mary was organizing the first class to be held in her new home, which she did early in April, having heard of Daniel Spofford's return to Lynn, she sent him a letter inviting him to join as a guest student. "Mr. Spofford," she wrote, "I tender you a cordial invitation to join my next class and receive my instructions in healing the sick without medicine, without money, and without price." He accepted immediately. Daniel Harrison Spofford was, in many ways, one of the most interesting of Mary Patterson's early followers. He was a great contrast to Richard Kennedy. Born at Temple, New Hampshire, he was early left an orphan, and at the age of 10 came with his elder brother and widowed mother to eastern Massachusetts. There, when little more than a child, he went to work on a farm, and although rather a frail boy, managed to do a man's work. Thoughtful and reflective by nature, he was an earnest student of the Bible, and even when a chore boy around the farm would often worry over the problems which a strong Calvinistic theology presented. Then, when he was 20, came the Civil War. He fought through it all, some 20 engagements, among them Gettysburg and the Second Battle of Bull Run, and was finally mustered out in 1864. Thereafter, he worked in a shoe factory in Lynn, as a farmer in the Far West, and now back again in Lynn as a practitioner and student of mental healing. It was no doubt because she recognized in him some qualities above the average that Mary Patterson invited Daniel to her class and gave him a receipt in full for the $300 which he otherwise would have had to pay. But whether she did or not, he quickly showed himself an exceptional student. And in less than a month after he entered the class, he had opened an office in Lynn and put out his sign, Dr. Spofford, Scientific Physician. His success was immediate and even more pronounced than that of Richard Kennedy. And yet, he had none of the qualities which were apparently the main cause of Richard's popularity. Richard was hail fellow well met with everybody, had a remarkable capacity for friendship, and a warm enjoyment of everything. Daniel, on the other hand, was an idealist and something of a dreamer, gentle in manner as he was somewhat frail in build. He carried about with him an atmosphere of aloofness, contrasting strangely with Richard's breezy intimacy. His success, like Kennedy's, lay in his healing works. People came to him in increasing numbers for healing, and Mary got into the way of turning over her students to him for further instruction. The little group was growing rapidly now, so much so that the Sunday morning gatherings were taxing severely the capacity of the front room at No. 8 Broad Street. It quickly became evident, indeed, that something would have to be done about it. And so, on June 1st, a meeting of students was held at the Broad Street house for the purpose of considering the advisability of renting a hall in which to hold public meetings. The resolution adopted at this meeting, which has, of course, a special historic interest, was as follows. Whereas, in times not long past, the science of healing, new to the age, and far in advance of all other modes, was introduced into the city of Lynn by its discoverer, a certain lady, Mary Baker Glover. And whereas many friends spread the good tidings throughout the place and bore aloft the standard of life and truth which had declared freedom to many manacled with the bonds of disease or error. And whereas by the willful and wicked disobedience of an individual who has no name in love, wisdom, or truth, the light was obscured by clouds of misinterpretation and mists of mystery, so that God's work was hidden from the world and derided in the streets. Now, therefore, we students and advocates of this moral science, called the science of life, have arranged with the said Mary Baker Glover to preach to us or direct our meetings on the Sabbath of each week, and hereby covenant with one another, and by these presents do publish and proclaim that we have agreed and do each and all agree to pay weekly for 1 year, beginning with the 6th day of June, A.D. 1875, to a treasurer chosen by at least 7 students the amount set opposite our names, provided, nevertheless, the monies paid by us shall be expended for no other purpose or purposes than the maintenance of said Mary Baker Glover as teacher or instructor, than the renting of a suitable hall and other necessary incidental expenses, and our signatures shall be a full and sufficient guarantee of our faithful performance of this contract. Signed, Elizabeth M. Newhall, $1.50. Daniel H. Spofford, $2. George H. Allen, $2. Dorcas B. Rawson, $1. Asa T. N. McDonald, 50 cents. George W. Berry, $2. S. P. Bancroft, 50 cents. Miranda R. Rice, 50 cents. This made a total of $10 a week. $5 were to be paid to Mrs. Patterson, the other $5 being used to defray the cost of renting a hall and other incidental expenses. The Sunday sessions, which were more in the nature of lecture gatherings than church services, provided a rallying point for her following, a sounding board for her crusade, and a satisfying compromise with her childhood congregationalism. On the following Sunday, June 6th, the first public Christian Science meeting was held in the Templars Hall. Putney Bancroft came over from Swampscott to lead the singing, while his wife played the melodeon. The congregation numbered between 60 and 70. The weekly meeting seemed fair to becoming a Sunday service. This first meeting appears to have been, in every way, a success. And no doubt, Mary and her faithful band looked forward to a peaceful development of their plan, increasing numbers and expanding usefulness. They were, however, quickly to learn that whatever things the future had in store for them, peace, as far as the outside world was concerned, was not to be one of them. Word of the meeting soon got abroad, and the merely curious came in ever larger numbers. With them also came the covertly and openly antagonistic. Mary Patterson's well-known condemnation of spiritualism brought many spiritualists to her Sunday services, and in the time reserved for questions, they sought in every way to trap her in her speech and involve her in argument. She struggled on valiantly for a time, but at length became convinced that no matter how successfully she might defend her teaching, the atmosphere of argument and contention was not what she and her followers were in search of. After the fifth meeting, the public Sunday services were abandoned. It must have been a disappointment, but it was not the first of many. And, after all, Mary Patterson's great work was the book, and that was now rapidly nearing completion. It was a hard task, but she was happy in it. Bancroft, in his memoirs, makes mention of this. "I consider," he says, "the summer of 1875 the most harmonious period of the 12 years from 1870 to 1882, during which Mrs. Eddy had continued to reside in Lynn. I never knew her so continuously happy in her work." and yet she could never have been able to see very far ahead. No publisher could be found who would even consider her book, and all her available funds had gone into the purchase of the Broad Street house. She would need some $1,500 to $2,000 if she was to publish it herself, and she had little or nothing. It was George Berry and Elizabeth Newhall who finally solved the problem. They decided to advance the money and publish the book themselves. And so, as far as the book was concerned, they disappeared as George Berry and Elizabeth Newhall, and reappeared within a few days as the Christian Science Publishing Company. They went to work with a will, but their troubles were far from over. Even with the money guaranteed and with a considerable sum paid in advance, the printer proved dilatory beyond all reason in carrying on the work. This very dilatoriness, however, in the end, resulted in a development of considerable importance and in an incident which evidently made a deep impression on Mary at the time and was often recalled by her afterwards. It appears that ever since she parted from Richard Kennedy, she had steadily become more and more convinced as to the dangers of mesmerism in any system of mental healing. She began to reason, first, that Quimby's teaching, consciously or unconsciously, had been based on mesmerism. And secondly, that wherever her own interpretation became involved in any way with Quimby's, it became obscured to that extent. She herself felt sure that she had carried through without any suggestion of mesmerism in her own practice. But developments seemed to indicate that certain people seized upon any mesmeric possibilities she allowed to remain, as Kennedy had done, and quickly developed them, until, as far as she could see, such doctrine crowded out all else. Mary Patterson was to encounter this again and again in the years that were to follow. Elements of Quimby's teaching, which she loyally but mistakenly associated with her own for so long, were to dog her steps right up to the end of her long life. In the spring and summer of 1875, the practice of Richard Kennedy was considered to be a kind of opposition camp in Lynn. He had a large clientele, but Mary Patterson decided that the effect of his work in a number of cases was like that of a habit-forming drug. The patient came more and more under his influence. She also became convinced of a growing enmity in the most unexpected quarters, and suspected with almost a sense of horror that when any of her students came under the influence of Kennedy, the most fantastic things were likely to happen. It was all new to her, but in the end, she seems to have reached the conviction that Kennedy was a mesmerist of the first water, that his one purpose was to see how far he could go, while the one consuming interest of his life was the exercise of his newfound power in any and every direction. At least, this was how she saw it, so she said. Her trying experiences of this period, interpreted in the light that all is mental, began to bring into sharp focus the heretofore nebulous doctrine of malicious mental malpractice, the teaching that one may be injured or destroyed through the secret, silent machinations of an enemy who has eaten of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So thoroughly did this view take hold that we find Mary Patterson working diligently and rallying her closest followers to work diligently with mental declarations designed to offset the enemy's attack and to render him impotent in his perfidy. It was considered possible that his directed malice might even return upon him to his own undoing, in a sort of law of compensation. Notes to her students to take up the culprit are still in the historical files, and they stand as milestones in the advancement of Christian Science doctrine, ever more out of the personal sense of the attack and defense, the affirmation and denial in treatment. With this conviction as to Kennedy and his purposes, apparently came another conviction, namely that the basis of Kennedy's seeming power was the general ignorance of what was going on. She herself was satisfied that just in proportion as she realized the intent of mesmerism, to that extent it was powerless. And out of all this grew the final conviction that she ought to embody something on the subject in her book. She was very late in doing this, and it is probable that if it had not been for the dilatoriness of the printer in Boston, she would not have done it, at any rate not at that time. In her account of the matter in Retrospection and Introspection, she tells how, as the weeks and even months passed, during which the printer was holding up the work, she at last yielded to the constant conviction that she should insert in the last chapter of her book a partial history of what she had already observed of mental malpractice. Thence onward, the work went through without further delay. And in the fall of 1875, the Christian Science Publishing Company had completed its task. The book was published under the title of Science and Health, and put on the market in an edition of 1,000 copies at a rate of $2.50 a copy. It was well printed on good paper in a substantial cloth binding of green, blue, gray, and brown. Daniel Spofford was placed in charge of sales and commenced his task by sending out copies for review to the most important New England newspapers, with the rather unfortunate request not to mention the book at all unless it could be reviewed favorably. Later on, Mary was to learn, if indeed she knew of Spofford's request, the wisdom of Mrs. Stevenson's dictum, "Speak for my son, or again my son, but I be speaking about my son." Most of the papers took the course of not mentioning the book at all. But those that did, some of them, like the Springfield Republican, of excellent standing, received it with surprising cordiality.